Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
A very good morning to you all, wherever you're listening to us from, and welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, lawyers and human rights activists march in the streets of Nairobi to protest the killing of human rights lawyer Willie Kimani, his client, and a taxi driver.
The Kenyan authorities, I invite them to do like a full and in-depth investigation and a prosecution to ensure that every single person involved in this is brought to account.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, while on a visit to Uganda, calls for concerted efforts to fight global terrorism.
We must condemn all acts of terrorism, whether they are perpetrated in Paris or Brussels, in Orlando or San Bernardino, in Tunis or Nairobi, to defeat terror and to secure our common future.
These stories and much more to come in the next 25 minutes. Stay tuned.
Top story.
Hundreds of Kenyans, including human rights activists, lawyers, and taxi operators, peacefully protested over what they said was the extrajudicial killing by police of human rights lawyer Willie Kimani, his client, and their driver, as a court ordered that three police officers be held for 2 weeks on charges they murdered the three men. Demonstrators carried a mock coffin emblazoned with the words "Stop extrajudicial killings." Others wore T-shirts with the slogan "Stop police executions." From Nairobi, James Shimanyula sent this report.
Human rights lawyer Willie Kimani disappeared last month after attending a court hearing in which he was defending a client against police criminal charges. He, his client, and a taxi driver were later discovered dead. Isaac Okero, chairman of the Law Society of Kenya, speaking to me on the sideline of the protest, wants quick action to be taken to identify the offenders so that justice is served.
The latest incidents, I think, are just perhaps the most significant illustration of what we can see is a systemic failure of the security structure. There have been complaints made regularly by different actors, but clearly the system is not able to address it.
Okero sends a strong message to the Kenyan government.
It is absolutely intolerable and unacceptable that this situation continues to pertain. It is now going to be a threat to the rule of law as we know it and a complete erosion of constitutional rights, so it must be addressed.
Claire Wilkinson, Kenya's field director for the International Justice Mission, also took part in the protest. This is what she had to say.
The Kenyan authorities, I invite them to do like a full and in-depth investigation and a prosecution to ensure that every single person involved in this is brought to account.
Heads of diplomatic missions in Kenya, led by United States, Canada, Britain and Australia, have equally expressed concern over the incident and called for immediate action. Holding police officers accountable for violations of human rights and other forms of misconduct, the diplomatic mission's statement said, is vital to end impunity in the police service and to establish safety and security for all Kenyans. Johnston Kariuki, an independent Nairobi analyst on Kenyan social issues, reflects on this.
It's high time our National Police Service cleaned up its image by axing, by removing completely those who have been implicated in gross violation of human rights. It's high time that the senior police bosses did that in order to win confidence of the public.
Ordinary Kenyans, including lawyers that participated in the protests, made varying comments on the killing of the three people.
I think the message is we need to re-examine what the reform process has been and whether we've actually seen any changes, because this kind of killing is telling of a more entrenched problem within the system, tied to culture, tied to the behavior within the law enforcement, and that's the action we're calling for.
There must be a way by which the government should deal with this menace, because these are not the first ones. Many have died silently. But if the government is not going to do anything, let the Kenyan civil society come up in arms and condemn this act as the worst act. And if not so, let the government resign.
Voices of frustrated Kenyans about extrajudicial killings, ending that report by James Shimanyula. So what impact will these protests have on police's methods of work? A question I put to Patrick Gathera, a political commentator and satirist in Nairobi.
I don't think that the protests themselves will have much of an impact. I mean, we've had complaints about extrajudicial executions by police and even harassment by police for a very long time. These have been highlighted in the press before. I'm not expecting that as a result of one protest that there will be huge changes. But this is all part and parcel, I think, of a wider effort to simply put pressure on government to enact the reforms that it promised within the police.
We've just heard from our correspondent James Shimanyula in Nairobi that the lawyers have vowed to boycott court sessions for 1 week in solidarity with their slain colleague. What effect is the boycott likely to have on court proceedings or sessions in the country?
It's hard to see how courts can operate without defense counsels. I mean, that would totally compromise the ability of people to get justice. So I think this will cripple the court system. But again, it will just be a way of putting pressure on government, because this will obviously become a big news item. We'll have lots of complaints. And I expect that government will feel pressure to actually speed up the reforms to the police, which everybody is pushing for, which we are all interested in.
Police in Kenya seems to act with excessive force when it comes to demonstrations, and also it normally acts out of impunity as well. Why is this the case?
Well, to understand this, you've got to go back to the formation of our police force. Our police force is over 100 years old. It was set up by the colonial government, essentially to protect the colonial government itself from the people. Its job was not to deliver services to the population or to protect the population. It was really to protect the colonial settlers or a small elite and the colonial government from the people. And it has never changed. We had a report done in 2009. It's called, known as the Ransley Report, which described the force as a punitive citizen containment squad. You know, and this is what it has remained as. And the impunity we see today is essentially as a result of that successive governments, even after independence, chose not to reform the service, chose not to change its ethos to be one that actually serves the people rather than polices them. And I think what we see today is a culmination of many, many years of government essentially politicizing the police force, using it as a tool to fight political battles, you know, and creating essentially a system of extraction and of looting that the police then protect, so that the police are more interested in protecting the big men in power than they are protecting us from those big men.
I was speaking to Patrick Gathera, a political commentator and satirist in Nairobi.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrived in Kenya, having been to Uganda a day before, where he and Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni held a ceremony marking the 40th anniversary of a hostage rescue raid in which Netanyahu's older brother was killed. Netanyahu was welcomed at Entebbe Airport, a lakeside facility with an old terminal where his brother Yonatan was struck by a bullet as he led Israeli commandos in a mission to rescue hijacked Israeli passengers. Also in Uganda, Netanyahu called for the fight against global terrorism. From Kampala, Alex Gita reports.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrived in Uganda at 1 p.m. and toured Entebbe Airport. Netanyahu said this visit was emotional to him as his brother's death changed the course and the purpose of his life. He said indeed the attack on Entebbe helped Israel rise against brutality.
The raid on Entebbe was a watershed moment in the life of my people. For centuries we were stateless and powerless to defend ourselves. We were murdered by the millions. The rise of Israel changed all that. Time and again, Israel has successfully defended itself against enemies committed to our destruction. But it was perhaps at Entebbe where this fundamental transformation was most dramatically seen by the world. We were powerless no more.
On terrorism, Netanyahu had no kind words for its perpetrators.
Nothing justifies terrorism. Nothing justifies the deliberate murder of the innocent, the systematic slaughter of civilians. We must condemn all acts of terrorism, whether they are perpetrated in Paris or Brussels, in Orlando or San Bernardino, in Tunis or Nairobi, to defeat terror and to secure our common future.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni welcomed Israel back to Africa, but also urged it to work towards resolving the issue between Israel and Palestine sooner rather than later.
The only way for you and for the world is for the two of you to agree to live side by side in two states, one Jewish and the other one Arab, in peace and with recognized borders. A lot of time has been lost and a lot of trouble has been kicked up, but I do not see any other way.
Netanyahu's visit is also intended to strengthen relations but also economic ties with Africa. While in Uganda, he also met with East African presidents in a brief summit. Netanyahu said Africa was a continent with opportunities and Israel was ready to work with it.
Africa is a continent on the rise. Israel looks forward to strengthening ties with all its countries. And I'm proud to be the first Israeli prime minister in over 20 years to come to visit sub-Saharan Africa. After many decades, I can say unequivocally, Israel is coming back to Africa and Africa is coming back to Israel. All of our peoples will benefit greatly from our growing partnership.
In Uganda, news of his visit was received with a lot of optimism.
We can benefit from the experience, especially security matters and agriculture, being an arid country but with a thriving agriculture sector, able to feed their people and even export.
This day, we should use it as an opportunity to exploit potentials that we have as Uganda and then potentials that the Israelis have as the government.
In a bid to strengthen economic ties with Africa, Netanyahu is traveling with a number of Israel investors to study the continent.
Alex Gita reporting from Kampala.
Africa on the move.
Now, African economies may be booming, but continued growth and quality of life are being jeopardized by lack of electricity. According to the International Energy Agency, IEA, close to 600 million people in sub-Saharan Africa don't have access to energy. A number of companies and organizations on the continent have identified solar power as the solution, and a new breed of solarpreneurs, as they call themselves, is emerging, increasing access to power and generating revenues at the same time. In Niger, Yesho Abdu is one of the solarpreneurs who are promoting the use of solar panels. This report by Yulia Heinishman is now presented by Chimwemwe Padata.
The idea to power grain mills with solar energy came from Yechu Abdu. Together with friends, he founded a cooperative to start his business, Gemafor Engineering. Until recently, the women in rural areas had to grind the grains by hand or with diesel-powered mills. Those days are over. Yechu Abdu has already sold 4 machines to communities. Each one costs the equivalent of 480 euros.
Between the time when I started my business and today, growth has been fast. The sector has experienced a real boom, and the population has come to see solar and photovoltaic equipment as a new way to obtain energy.
Abdu was supported by the startup center in Kipmen, in Niam. Here, young entrepreneurs can meet, work together and network. They develop apps, GPS systems for transport companies, or they have new ideas for the energy sector. Amta Aloli is the executive director of Kipmen, and he explains.
La culture entrepreneuriale.
Business culture is not widespread in society here. Many people work in the informal sector, and today we are trying, with our structure and the possibilities we have, to change this mentality.
On mise beaucoup sur ce changement de mentalité.
Many people in Niger get by with occasional jobs or by working as unskilled laborers. For anyone wanting to start up a company, it's hard to get a bank credit or a start-up loan. Here too, the Kipment Center wants to help. Alauli again.
Nous catalysons beaucoup.
We catalyze many actors who can help the young entrepreneurs implement their ideas. For example, we establish contact with the minister or with state institutions. And in the private sector, too, we open doors so that they can start their businesses.
Yechu Abdu has succeeded with his grain mills. He has filled a business niche. For the population at large, he invented a solar-powered multiple socket strip. It can be used to charge 25 cell phones, lamps, and other equipment.
Between the time when I started my business and today, growth has been fast. The sector has experienced a real boom, and the population has come to see solar and photovoltaic equipment as a new way to obtain energy.
The entrepreneur now employs 5 young men who deliver and set up the equipment in villages throughout the country.
That report was by Yulia Heinrichmann. Police in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, on Monday fired tear gas and water cannons in an attempt to quell rioting by minibus drivers and others protesting what they describe as police harassment. The violence came amid a surge in protests in recent weeks because of increasing economic hardship and alleged mismanagement by the government of President Robert Mugabe. Many rioters were young men who can't find regular employment and make a living off drivers by charging a small fee to load passengers into minibuses. So how big is the issue of unemployment, especially among the youth in Zimbabwe? A question I put to DW's Privilege Mushaniri in Harare.
Unemployment issues are quite big in Zimbabwe. You find that it is estimated that 80% of the youth are unemployed in Zimbabwe, and you have a whole generation that is in the 30s, in the 40s, who have graduated from universities, from colleges, who have been seated at home and they can't find a job.
The drivers' grievances stem from anger over numerous roadblocks that police sometimes set up in city streets, which drivers allege are to demand bribes. What has been the reaction from the police over such serious allegations?
The police, if you hear them or if you talk to them, they are saying that they are just implementing the law. But the implementation of the law, it has also even raised concerns from the Zimbabwe Parliament. The legislators have also raised the issue to say that, you know, the roadblocks are too many. You would find that probably in a distance of 20 kilometers, you can have more than 5 checkpoints. Or if you come into the city, you won't drive for 2 kilometers or 3 kilometers without meeting any police checkpoint. And also you have police patrolling with motorbikes. And what is happening is that every policeman, if you meet them, they have got a receipt book and they are asking for spot fines.
Privilege, what kind of law are we talking about here?
The law that they are talking about, you know, there's a whole list of traffic offenses. Whenever a vehicle is stopped, particularly the public taxis, the police won't, you are assured that that taxi, they will find something that they will penalize you.
Now, acts of defiance and clashes with the police are rare in Zimbabwe. But just like you mentioned, in recent weeks, there have been protests as a result of frustration over the deteriorating economic situation. Could this be only the beginning of citizens' fight against oppression in all its forms?
We could safely say so, because you find that slowly it is not only the taxi drivers who are expressing their anger. You have so many groups now, so many demonstrations that are sprouting from different parts of Zimbabwe. Recently, the government of Zimbabwe introduced what they call the Statutory Instrument 64, which is to enforce the prohibition of importation of certain basic food goods from neighboring countries, particularly from South Africa. And you find that most people in Zimbabwe, because of the unemployment levels, they are surviving on cross-border trading. So that basically means those that were surviving on cross-border trading will not have any way to survive on.
I was speaking to Privilege Mushanri in Harare.
Making a difference.
For Making a Difference this week, we bring you the story of Diana Akech, a Kenyan beautician in Nairobi, who's handing out free wigs to cancer patients and survivors who are losing their hair due to chemotherapy. Her goal is to aid survivors to recover and battle cancer-related discrimination. Andrew Wasike visited her beauty parlor and salon in Nairobi and sent this report.
Here's your baby. It's ready. We need to adjust the book so that it can be able to fit you.
Hair loss is one of the challenges that cancer patients from around the globe have to live with. The World Health Organization says that in many countries, breast cancer is among the most commonly diagnosed cancers and a major cause of death among women. In Kenya, those who are diagnosed with it are put under treatment known as chemotherapy, which uses drugs to destroy cancer cells. However, the treatment leads to loss of hair, and hence some patients are discriminated. Diana Akech, 38 years old, is a beautician. She provides wigs for free of charge to cancer patients through her charity called the Pink Butterfly Foundation. As a philanthropist, she says, she believes in alleviating the suffering that cancer patients go through. Akech was attending to Sarah Wangui, who was diagnosed with stage 3 cancer and has lost her hair due to chemotherapy.
I was diagnosed with cancer in November. It was on stage 3. They operated on one breast. Now I'm using artificial breast, plastic one.
Wangui's hair had started to fall off after her first chemotherapy session. She says she was discriminated and that made her to feel as if her life didn't matter anymore.
For me, it started day one. The first day I went for chemo, all my hair, I woke up in the morning, I found them on top of my pillow. I screamed too much.
From that point, she says her health started worsening as she received very cold treatment from her neighbors.
People take us that you are different, as if you are going to transmit the disease to anybody. Even some people don't want to share a seat in Namatatu. They say you are going to transmit. But you see, when I put over and I do my makeup, they won't discriminate me and stigmatize me.
Diana Akech has brought hope to many cancer patients. The wigs cost around 250 euros and are given to them for free. Akech says that she got the idea from a friend of hers who had lost her hair due to undergoing cancer treatment.
When she was going to pay me, I told her, I don't want your money. I'm going to do it for free, because I thought maybe she's going through the medication and it's expensive. We gave her and she was in tears, and it was very moving for me. So that's when I thought, and I said, Diana, why can't you just try and touch as many hearts as you can? So that's how I came up with this program.
So far, Akech has supported more than 30 women who are undergoing breast cancer treatment. Well-wishers and some of her clients have been contributing to her charity. She calls on more people to support her initiative.
Apart from just giving them the wigs, we're giving them hope, we're giving them the smile back. Cancer is real, it's affecting everybody, and we all know what they go through in chemo. It's not easy. We accept any sort of support you can give us, because we want to reach to as many people as we can. The few cancer survivors I've met, believe you me, it has been a big boost to them, to their ego, to their self-esteem. It's amazing.
That report was filed by Andrew Wasike in Nairobi. And before we leave you, a reminder of the stories that we've covered in the last 25 minutes. Lawyers and human rights activists protested in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, over the killing of human rights lawyer Willie Kimani, his client and taxi driver. Also in the program, we've been hearing how a Kenyan beautician is putting a smile on the faces of cancer survivors by providing them with free wigs to raise their self-esteem. Remember, one way you can comment on these stories is by sending an email to feedback.africa@dw.com. I'm Isaac Mugabe in Bonn, Germany, wishing you a splendid day ahead.